texts and calls, which had finally gotten straight in the database. Reggie had sent a text at 6:17, another at 6:43, another at 6:45, another at 6:46. Singleton thought, he was texting when the crash happened. He didn't call Rendlesbacher, not yet. He didn't want to be wrong. There were too many unknowns. Among them, who was Reggie texting? All the messages had gone to the same number. Singleton considered calling the number, but then he thought, I've got to proceed cautiously. Someone might answer and then just go cold on me, shut me down or out. Several days later, Singleton got out a piece of paper, and he wrote down the sequence of events from the crash report, when the accident took place, when the 911 calls came in, and he wrote down the times of all of Reggie's texts. He climbed into the aging Smurf blue Ford Taurus that was his state-provided car. It was 10:30 in the morning. He drove to Tremonton, Reggie's hometown, and then he commenced retracing Reggie's drive, matching times with texts, which had commenced with the one sent at 6:17. As he approached the gun range near the mile marker where the accident took place, Singleton was struck by two things. One, he was having trouble watching the road and looking down at his piece of paper, a challenge that reinforced his astonishment that someone could simultaneously text and drive. And two, there was no doubt. Reggie had been texting the entire way. He had been texting when he caused the crash. Questions whirred through Singleton's mind. How do we prove this? Who was Reggie texting? Who belonged to the number on the other end of the texts? March 17, 2007 was St. Patrick's Day. In Salt Lake City, a 17-year-old girl named Lauren Mulkey had freshly returned from a family vacation in Florida. In the early evening, she put on a bright yellow halter top to show off her tan, jeans, and big green hoop earrings, and set out with friends to celebrate the Irish holiday. The last thing she heard was a warning. I told her, "Be careful of drunk drivers," says her mother Linda. At midnight, now March 18th, she was returning home, sober. Coming the other direction was Theodore Jorgensen, 19. At a thoroughfare near the University of Utah, he drove through a red light. Nor did he see Lauren's Mercedes SUV passing through the intersection, perpendicular to him. He smashed into the driver's side of the car. It flipped. Lauren died almost instantly from massive head wounds. According to prosecutors, Jorgensen had been on the phone prior to the accident. Lauren's mother Linda says, I never thought to warn her about the phone. Chapter 20. The Neuroscientists. In a small, windowless room in Fraser Hall at the University of Kansas, a junior named Maggie Biberstein sits in a contraption that resembles a driving video game at an arcade. There are brake and accelerator pedals at her feet. She grips a steering wheel. She looks at a screen on the wall on which is projected a highway scene, the setting she is supposed to steer a virtual car through. It's a driving simulator, and it's telling Dr. Atchley and his collaborators something about Maggie's relationship to technology. Maggie's job is to drive the car and focus on the road, but she's also supposed to keep an ear out for her phone in case a text comes in. That's not uncommon for her. I sometimes text while I drive, she says a bit sheepishly. She wears jeans and a green sweater over a blue shirt. She grew up in Manhattan, Kansas, where she got her first phone when she was 16. She tries not to use her phone when she studies, but it's hard to ignore. The device is so important for social uses. She's heavily involved in her sorority, Alpha Delta Pi, where, for instance, she recently helped write a musical. What is the value of social connection? How does it impact the lure of the phone? And when it comes to social connection, what is the value of immediate gratification? In a prior groundbreaking experiment published in 2012, Dr. Atchley and a colleague explored these questions. Dr. Atchley used a basic premise. He theorized that if technology was like an addictive substance, say alcohol, then users would find the information delivered on a device as irresistible as alcoholics do booze. In the first part of the experiment, 35 students were asked about how they value money and how they value information. In the case of money, the subjects were asked if they would prefer to take a small amount of money, say $5, versus waiting a period of time to get more money, say $100. The students were asked about other time periods too, and other amounts of money, enabling the researchers to assess how the students value money over time. Put another way, how urgent is their desire for money? In the second part of the experiment, the researchers asked similar questions, but this time, they focused on the value of information. For instance, students were told they've received a text from their significant other. They were promised they could get $5 if they responded immediately, or $100 if they waited an hour to respond. There were other intermediate options, such as respond in 5 minutes or 30 minutes with corresponding rewards. This kind of science has been termed neuroeconomics, a subset of which is known as delay discounting. It is a way of understanding decision-making on various issues, say, when a person responds to a text, by using economic or monetary measures and influences. What the researchers found was that students thought the value of a text fell much more quickly than did the value of money. On average, $100 lost about 25% of its value if a student had to wait 12 days to get paid, and it lost 50% of the value if students had to wait 142 days to get paid, on average. Despite some erosion, money retained value over relatively long periods. Not so with a text. In the case of a text, the information lost one quarter of its value in 10 minutes and half its value in 5 hours. Information loses a lot of value in a short period of time. Money retains its value over time. The results stand to reason, Dr. Ashley explains. If a friend texts and says, "I'll be at a party later," and you don't pick up the text until tomorrow, you may as well have not bothered to pick up the phone. In a second phase of the experiment, the researchers added a twist. Would the value of information be discounted even further, be even more urgent, depending on who it was from? What they found was there was a decided increase in the sense of urgency when the text came from a significant other, as opposed to a friend or more distant acquaintance. Specifically, when the text came from a boyfriend or wife, for instance, the value of texting back fell 25% after just 25 minutes, compared to 3 hours for a friend or 10 hours for an acquaintance. The dry vernacular of the science paper read, "The current data shows the need to text now may simply reflect the need to engage in a behavior that only has value in the short term." There was another critical conclusion from the experiment. The college students made what Dr. Atchley calls a rational assessment of the value of the information. They didn't just have a knee-jerk reaction to immediately respond to the text. If they had done that, Dr. Atchley thought, their relationship to crucial social information would begin to look more like that of an alcoholic to booze. In that relationship, the alcoholic places urgent value on, say, getting one beer today, even if he can get a 12-pack if he waits a week. The college students, by contrast, were willing to wait a bit, and they were prepared to wait more or less time depending on who the text was from. That is a rational response, Dr. Atchley thought, not the response of an addict. Maybe, he thought, technology creates more of a compulsion than an addiction. He needed to dig deeper to understand where the lure of technology fit on this continuum. In another experiment aimed at refining the answers, Dr. Atchley is working with scientists at the Imaging Center in Kansas City. There, they're comparing the brains of smokers to those of internet addicts. When a smoker anticipates a cigarette, does his brain look the same as when a Facebook user anticipates getting a status update? And in yet another experiment, his team is asking a question related to distracted driving. What is more powerful? The lure of the social information, or the demands of the road? That's what Maggie is doing in the lab today. It's just one little building block, but they're about to be surprised by the result. Next to the room where Maggie sits in the driving simulator is another small room. It has three computer screens and one television monitor that are receiving a feed from a camera that's recording what Maggie is doing. Watching is Chelsea Headlock, a researcher in Dr. Atchley's lab. As she observes Maggie, she uses one of the computers in the room to send Maggie occasional texts. There are two kinds of texts. One involves driving directions that Maggie must take to get to a party. The other are related to social information about the party and who will be there. The researcher taps out, "Michelle keeps asking when you're going to get here." Maggie taps back, "I think I'll be there soon. How do I get there?" The researcher texts how to get to the party, what street to turn left on, and how many blocks Maggie must go. Maggie drives on through the simulator, finishing the highway portion, heading into an urban environment. The researcher texts, "Gendry is getting wasted. Why aren't you here yet?" The simulation is not intended to measure how well Maggie texts and drives, though the researchers confirm that she and other participants are horrible at it. Crash risk soars. Something else happens too, perhaps less expected. The social information seems to pave over the value of the driving information. At the end of the simulation, Maggie takes a quiz. What does she remember about the drive? What she recalls are the names and details of the lives of all the fictional characters from the party. Michelle and Gendry and Michael. What she misses in the quiz? Everything else. The driving directions, the number of intersections she passed, the building she passed. Getting information of value seems to explain some of the powerful lure of technology. But Dr. Atchley points to a fascinating brain study that underscores how our devices also play a deep need to share information, not just receive it. The research shows that we get important neurochemical releases not just when we disclose personal information, something enabled greatly by email, text, or status updates on various sites. In a study published in The Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2012, researchers from Harvard University used MRI scans to look inside the brain and ask, what happens when we disclose information? What they found was that the reward areas of the brain get lit up when people share. Here, we suggest that humans so willingly self-disclose because doing so represents an event with intrinsic value in the same way as with primary awards such as food and sex. Reinforcing that finding is research by Dr. Gloria Mark, a professor at the University of California at Irvine, who found through survey studies that people are happier at work when they use Facebook more. Not more engaged with their job, but happier. That comes in part from posting stuff. Sharing. The researchers added another layer to that finding by looking at whether the reward circuitry in the brain was more or less excited when the person was disclosing the information, not in a vacuum or in private, say by writing the information onto a piece of paper, a diary if you will, but when the disclosure was certain to be seen by someone, particularly a friend or family member. To measure this, the researchers conducted a version of the neuroeconomics experiments that Dr. Atchley and many others had used, in this case, trying to put a relative monetary value on disclosing something in private versus disclosing to another person. Although participants were willing to forego money merely to introspect about the self, and doing so was sufficient to engage brain regions associated with the rewarding outcomes, these effects were magnified by knowledge that one's thoughts would be communicated to another person, suggesting that individuals find opportunities to disclose their own thoughts to others to be especially rewarding, the researchers wrote. They concluded, "The motivation to disclose our internal thoughts and knowledge to others may serve to sustain the behaviors that underlie the extreme sociality of our species." Part of the reason why it's not so easy to understand the powerful lure of technology, is it addictive, the cause of extreme compulsion, or simply habit-forming, has to do with the complexity of the technology itself. Various mechanisms are at work. Some have to do with the nature of the information the devices deliver, the value, say, of personal information, or the value of good news versus bad news. Some are more purely mechanical, having to do with how the information is delivered. For instance, The speed at which a device delivers information can dictate how drawn we are to it. Another mechanical piece has to do with the way our brains get stimulated by the mere act of touching the device, and in doing so, causing something to happen. Touch the keyboard, and a letter appears. Touch the screen, and an email opens, or a gun shoots in a video game. This step is separate from, and arguably more primitive than, the receiving of information. In fact, even before we get information, we are getting some stimulation through an active stimulus response. An additional factor that can dictate how compulsively we use our devices has to do with individual personality and predilection. Some people appear more susceptible than others. Different researchers are exploring the different mechanisms, and they are doing so using a growing set of tools. Some research focuses on behavior, like the stuff Dr. Atchley does. Some involves imaging. Dr. Atchley does that too, but it's more the domain of scientists like Dr. Ghazali. And there's another way of looking at these various mechanisms. It entails looking at neurochemicals triggered when people play video games or use the internet. The tools to measure such activity are evolving too. And they show that the use of certain kinds of interactive media stimulate neurological patterns similar to those produced by the use of addictive drugs. To learn more, Dr. Atchley suggests I talk to an internet addiction specialist named David Greenfield. He's looked closely at the chemical relationship between drugs and technology, and he knows whereof he speaks, having struggled with drug use himself. Chapter 21. Terrell. Mary Surratt ran the boarding house where John Wilkes Booth planned the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Evidence of her guilt was conflicting, but she was found guilty of conspiracy in the president's murder and sentenced to hang. Early in 2007, as the case against Reggie was inching along, Terrell's oldest daughter Jamie, a sixth grader, had become interested in Mary Surratt. Jamie started building an exhibit for the Utah History Fair. It included a description, photos, and a hangman's noose. What made the noose unusual was that it had 5 loops in it, rather than 13, just like the noose that Surratt's hangman had fashioned at the time, because he didn't believe Surratt should hang, and he thought a noose with fewer loops would break. In early April, Jamie won the junior division of the state competition, making her eligible to compete in Washington, D.C., on National History Day that summer. It was the first of what would become a string of academic successes for the Warner children, in the classroom and in competitions outside of it. Jamie formed the early idea she might be a doctor. I hate to see anyone in pain or suffer. She excelled in school, setting a bar her brother felt eager to match. When Taylor was in the second grade, the school's principal suggested Taylor skip third grade and move on to fourth. That year in fourth grade, Taylor went to the house of a friend whose dad was a heart surgeon. He decided right then and there he wanted to be a doctor, though not a heart surgeon, because he thought, ugh, the heart's gross. He became determined to be a neurosurgeon. The brain, he says he'd concluded, is so cool. For Terrell, the exhilaration around learning was a sign of the enthusiasm she tried to instill in her children, tried to exhibit for them. This was the personal analog for Terrell of her zeal at work. She was desperate to be an engaged parent, 180 degrees of difference from how she felt her parents treated her. If a child got interested in a project or hobby, Terrell was there, driving them to whatever event, staying up late with preparations. It was the zeal of a convert, and just as at work, her enthusiasm at home could tread a line. In the back of the house, she and Alan had cleared out a big backyard. But it wasn't particularly hospitable to play. Then, it sunk in with Terrell that the neighbor had a backhoe. I decided I wanted a sandpit for the kids. With the neighbor's help, she dug a hole around 4 feet deep, 20 feet wide, and 10 feet long. She ordered a huge dump truck full of sand, and she had it poured into the hole. There's a picture of Taylor with his friend and neighbor Travis, both 5 years old, buried up to their necks in sand. They had a chocolate lab named Luke, Jamie and Taylor would tie a red wagon to Luke and then throw a ball across the sandpit, and the dog would race to get it, the wagon trailing behind. In April of 2001, Alyssa was born, and she was little more than 1 year old when her older siblings would put her in the back of the wagon, and Luke the dog would pull her around, sometimes chasing the ball. Terrell and Alan put in a tetherball court, a trampoline, a swing set. Money was tight, but it was low-cost entertainment. Terrell could garden and be with them without being in their faces. Sometimes Alyssa would fall out of the red wagon with Luke the lab carrying her across the sand. She'd go flying out, Terrell laughs, looking back. The girl didn't get hurt. But it did exemplify how Terrell, in her zeal to be supportive and fun, to encourage a spirit of adventure, could push things to the edge. When Taylor was around 6, he expressed an interest in science. Terrell got him a microscope and a chemical experiment kit that had test tubes in glass straws, an alcohol burner, steel wool, and small containers of some not insignificant chemicals like hydrochloric acid, sodium carbonate, and calcium hydroxide. "My mother was always there and always giving us crazy things to do," Taylor says. A few years later, she took them to a nearby park, a nearly daily activity. Taylor wanted to ride the zip line. It was this thing where the adult gave you a little shove, and you glided about 8 feet to the other end of the line, feet dangling a few feet above the ground. "I asked my mom to push me," Taylor recalls. He rode the line. "I asked her to push me harder, and she did. I asked her to push me really, really, really hard, and she did, and I fell and I broke both my wrists. It was funny, but not at the time. At the time, it hurt." It was a hard line for Terrell to draw, the line between support and engagement and going overboard, wanting so much to be involved and to let them have a childhood. Always there was the specter of what she'd missed. "I lived it every day," she says, thinking back. "The way I raised my children, I put a stop to domestic violence in my home. I put a stop to alcoholism in my home. I was a chain breaker, is the way I view it." There was one step in particular she felt was essential in spurring her children to be engaged at home and in school. When Jamie was 5 years old and Taylor was 3, Terrell cut the family's cable TV service. Lots of families cut television when the kids are young, hoping to cut down screen time. For Terrell, the step was substantive and symbolic. One of the few things she felt good about her own childhood, other than her devotion to the church and reading, was that she didn't watch a lot of television. Her mom sent her and Michael out of the house into the yard, which Terrell thought had less to do with any enlightened parenting philosophy and more to do with keeping Danny happy. There was another motivator. Terrell remembered her mother-in-law, Alan's mother, as someone who didn't get out of bed because all she wanted to do was watch TV. "We were both greatly affected by parents who didn't get involved," Terrell says. "I just wasn't going to plop them in front of the TV." Terrell hadn't looked at the scientific research, but it was showing that television could have a powerful impact on the relationship between parents and their children. That's because television plays to our attention systems in extraordinary ways, using light, sound, and story. The science explains why, for all the growth in our other gadgets, television remains the single most dominant form of media. When the television is on, parents and children disengage from one another. The parents, even if not instructed to watch television, talk less to their children and respond less to children's inquiries and efforts to get attention, according to a summary published in 2009 by some of the field's leading researchers at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. In the study, parents interacted with their children 68% of the time when the television was off and 54% of the time when it was on. Further, the research showed the quality of the interaction fell too, with the parent less likely to be engaged or even look at the child when they do interact. But so what? So what if parent-child interaction falls? Researchers said that when parents talk to their children less, engage less, in a nutshell, put their attention to the television, not the children, it can eventually retard language development. As the 2009 study concluded, The evidence is growing that very early exposure to television is associated with negative developmental outcomes. It also appears young children who watch television can experience shorter-term effects. In 2011, Pediatrics, the scientific journal of the American Academy of Pediatrics, published the results of a study that measured performance of 4-year-olds on certain mental tasks after showing some of them 9-minute clips of a fast-paced cartoon, SpongeBob SquarePants, while showing other children either a slower-paced show or having them draw and not watch television at all. The children who watched the fast-paced show were less able to follow directions and, in a separate set of tasks, showed less patience. These are executive function tasks, meaning they engage the prefrontal cortex, that all-important part of the brain involved in focus. The researchers wrote that the toll taken on executive function came not just from the fast pace, but perhaps from the fantastical nature of the cartoon, which gave the children's brains a lot of information to digest, thus potentially depleting cognitive resources. The researchers wrote, "The result is consistent with others showing long-term negative associations between entertainment television and attention." Among those studies, one published in Pediatrics in 2004 found that children who watch more television in their toddler years are significantly more likely to have attention problems by age 7. There's another impact from high television use. Heavy television watching creates a sedentary lifestyle, less activity, more weight gain, even obesity. The weight gain comes not only as a result of the sedentary nature of television watching, or even chiefly because of it. Rather, it's the advertisements of junk food, notes the Harvard School of Public Health in a health advisory titled, "The Small Screen Looms Large in the Obesity Epidemic." Increasingly, though, there's evidence that watching TV, and especially watching junk food ads on TV, promotes obesity by changing mainly what and how much people eat, less so by changing how much they move. So why is television so alluring? The reasons are more complicated than meets the eye. They have to do with attention capture and attention theory. One of the leading researchers in the field, who helped write the 2009 Amherst paper, is named Daniel Anderson, a professor at UMass Amherst, and he's anything but a purebred television antagonist. In fact, he's consulted to numerous television shows, including Sesame Street, Dora the Explorer, and Blue's Clues. Dr. Anderson has concluded that television's lure owes its powerful appeal to two parts of attention that often compete: the top-down system and the bottom-up system. To recap, top-down attention is the power people have to set goals and focus on them, while the bottom-up attention systems, very primitive systems, get captured by changes in light and sound and movement, and in effect, warn the top-down systems that there is a potentially relevant change to the environment, perhaps an opportunity or threat. Dr. Anderson has found that babies mostly glance at television because of the bottom-up system. In other words, they are responding to changes in sound and light. When there is a change, you want to find out what it is. Then, as early as 1.5 years old, children begin to process the information on the screen, and then a higher order of thinking gets involved, Dr. Anderson has found. They want to understand what's happening on the screen. This begins the engagement of their top-down attention systems, as the children focus on what's happening in the show, the content, rather than merely being drawn in by the lights and sounds. This doesn't make the changes in light and sound and movement irrelevant. In fact, what makes television so powerful, Dr. Anderson notes, is that it uses these attention capture tools to constantly draw people back into the story, should their top-down focus waver. Television always had that lower level working for it, he says, noting the mix of top-down and bottom-up tools. Well-produced television makes it a fairly seamless experience. You're getting attention brought back to the screen in a way you don't feel you're being manipulated. Adding to the lure, he said, there's a concept of attentional inertia, which shows that the longer someone stays engaged with the television, the more likely that person is to have trouble pulling away. This is the case even when the television flashes to a commercial, Dr. Anderson explains. suggesting that the attention systems lock on even when the narrative isn't engaging the top-down systems. Dr. Anderson has worked on many of the most popular children's shows and is far less critical of television than some researchers. He thinks the right programming can be educational and informative. At the same time, he agrees there's reason to be wary of too much television viewing, largely in light of the opportunity costs. The more you watch television, the less you're interacting with other people, talking to your parents, moving your body.
It doesn't make watching television bad for the kids, he says, but adds, there are probably 1,000 better things to do at any given time than watching any given television program.
Television turns out to be powerful because it so effectively plays the top-down and bottom-up attention systems against each other. But that's mere child's play compared to the way personal communications devices can commandeer those systems. Television, after all, has plots that, while interesting, are not personal. Sure, you care what happens in Orange is the New Black or The Real Housewives of New Jersey, but your phone and computer are bringing you a plot that is about your life. Your top-down system is heavily invested, and it gets reinforced by the bottom-up pings alerting you to what are, in a sense, plot updates. And so, as powerful a draw as television remains, our modern devices command our attention like nothing before. Chapter 22. Hunt for Justice. Since Reggie was a kid, he'd had a few favorite passages from the Book of Mormon. After the accident, another passage spoke to him. Therefore, this life became a probationary state, a time to prepare to meet God, a time to prepare for that endless state which has been spoken of by us, which is after the resurrection of the dead. Throughout the spring, the family worked through a process that was both bureaucratic and spiritual, aimed at getting Reggie back on track for a mission. He had more than a few hurdles, given that he'd already returned home after lying to a bishop about his premarital sex. And now, he had this amorphous, ominous legal cloud. In April, church leaders explained the steps he'd need to take. Among them was composing a letter about his interests and commitment. He wrote that the tests of the last year had brought him closer to God and to his religion, that he'd never wavered in his faith, and that, but for a few months where he'd been absent from prayer in the church, he'd found time to do his studying and reading. Even on my worst day, a mission was something that I knew I wanted to do. In this unusual case, Mormon officials needed to get more information. Records show that John Bunderson, the Shaw's attorney, talked to church officials in early June, giving them qualified reassurance that Reggie could go on a mission. He'd had no indication otherwise from police investigators that Reggie was at fault in the deaths of Jim and Keith. Scott Singleton's case notes show that from late March through April and into May, he hunted down who Reggie'd been texting on the morning of the accident. If he could find out who the number belonged to, he could try to prove what the phone records seemed to show, that Reggie was texting during the accident or right around it. He could find out what Reggie had been texting about, what had distracted him. Was there a much clearer, if tragic, reason that two men had been killed? Singleton's frustrations in trying to track down the answers were understandable to anyone who has ever had to deal with the phone company. Navigating phone trees or getting help from people on the other end of the line who don't know the answers. There was an added layer of complexity when it was a legal case. The phone company had to make sure the subpoena was in order. Now, there were multiple phone companies and different numbers. Lots of bureaucracy. On March 19th, Singleton met with Tony Baird, the deputy county attorney, to get a subpoena on the new mystery phone number that appears on Reggie's records as being texted at the time of the accident. For his part, Baird continued to keep the case at intellectual arm's length. He was still very early in the process. He had plenty of work to do, a newborn at home, the fourth for Baird and his wife. Besides, Baird remained skeptical that the Shaw case would amount to much. He saw his job at this point as mainly making sure that Singleton was crossing his T's and dotting his I's. And
He was impressed by this new investigator. He was meticulous. He was very, very particular. Not that Renlisbacher isn't, Baird recalls. Singleton's more analytical. Step by step, block by block. By now, though, Singleton was also doing his best Renlisbacher impersonation. He was obsessed. Not only did he get everything signed by Baird that March morning, he also dropped the subpoena off at 444 North Main Street, the Singular store, to a woman identified in his case notes only as Chris. Exactly 2 weeks later, at 3:20 in the afternoon, Singleton called the Cache County Attorney's Office to see if they'd heard back from AT&T. No, the company had not complied. So the next day, Singleton met with Baird, who suggested the investigator call AT&T's legal department. Adding yet another wrinkle, Singular and AT&T had recently merged. He wound up calling Singular's legal department, who told him such requests could take 10 to 15 days, an amount of time that had already elapsed. Singleton was getting frustrated, and he wasn't the only one. On April 13th, a Friday, Singleton heard from Renlisbacher. "Keith's wife, Leila, wants to know what's going on with the subpoena," the trooper told the investigator. "Working on it. I think I'm close." Singleton wasn't. There was a practically comical twist coming. On May 7th, Singleton called AT&T's legal department. Another pester. His case notes read, they stated that the phone number belongs to T-Mobile. He'd been barking up the wrong phone company. All this time wasted. But a few hours later, after talking to T-Mobile's legal department, he came to understand how he can make such a mistake. T-Mobile confirmed that the phone number had switched to its service from Singular AT&T on September 6th. That was just 3 weeks before the accident. That very day, Singleton wrote another subpoena, took it to Baird on Tuesday, May 8th, and got it off to T-Mobile. Then, not surprisingly, more bureaucracy, waiting, and back and forth. On May 23rd, he spoke to T-Mobile and was told he needed to fax the subpoena to a legal compliance agent in T-Mobile's law enforcement relations group. That same day, at just a few minutes after noon, he called Leila to let her know the gears continued to grind. The next day, Singleton pestered the T-Mobile agent. She told Singleton she had news. "We're faxing the information tomorrow." When he heard it, he felt a chill. His case notes don't reflect the excitement he felt when the fax arrived. "Received fax from T-Mobile. Brianna Bishop, 12887, is the owner of the phone number." Brianna Bishop, age 19. The woman on the other end of the text. The day after receiving the information about Bishop, Singleton called a fellow investigator, Stan Olson. Previously, Olson had held Singleton's post in Brigham City, but had since moved to the Farmington office, which was located closer to where Brianna Bishop lived. Singleton and Olson discussed how to approach Brianna, and they decided to jointly interview her after Singleton made the initial contact. He called the mystery woman at 2:30 on May 29th. "Ms. Bishop, my name is Agent Scott Singleton. I'm calling from the Utah Bureau of Investigation." "Hello? What's this about?" "I can't tell you over the phone. I'd like to arrange a time to get together." At 2:48, Brianna called back. They arranged to meet the next night after work at the Farmington office. Singleton was excited. He might finally get some concrete answers. It wouldn't be so easy. Between the time that Singleton called Brianna at 2:30 p.m. and the time she called back, she had two other phone calls. One was made to her friend Tricia, who was dating Reggie. The other call was with Reggie himself. It lasted 11 minutes. The next night, Singleton and Agent Olson gathered around a wooden table in the modest Davis County office of the Highway Patrol in Farmington with Brianna Bishop and her father Steve Bishop. In Brianna, Singleton saw a young, blonde 19-year-old who was nervous, very nervous. She wore work clothes. Singleton wore a dark shirt and a tie. He recorded the interview. "You're not in any trouble, but We do believe that you have some critical information that you can supply to us, Singleton told her, according to the transcript. I'm going to show you a series of photographs, he said. He showed her photos of young men, white, short hair, clean-cut young men who at a distance could be mistaken for Reggie. She didn't recognize them. He showed her Reggie's picture. Do you know that young man? Yes. Okay. And who is he? Reggie Shaw. Singleton asked their relationship, and she explained, we kind of dated a little bit, but we were mostly just friends. We hardly talk anymore. Singleton asked what she knew about the accident. A little bit. Not too much, though, Brianna said. What can you tell me about it? The morning that it happened, I got up, and I was getting ready for work, and I just texted him like I normally did because I was dating him that day. And I so texted him to say good morning and what was up and stuff, and he texted me back and told me that he had just gotten in an accident, and he thinks that the other two guys were dead, and he was freaking out. And so he texted you and said Brianna cut him off. It was after it happened. Then I called to see if he was okay. Singleton had figured this would be a tough interview, and that Brianna, being a friend of Reggie, may be evasive or even dishonest. He was also extremely aware of the other key person in the room, Brianna's dad. As Singleton would say later, we were having to appease her father. He didn't want to see her raked over the coals. Initially, Singleton started to try to draw her out. He pressed gently for her to explain the initial text. Who had sent it? She had, she said. And then Agent Olson asked, you said good morning, and his response was, I just got in an accident, and I'm freaking out, and I think the other two guys are dead. What Brianna apparently didn't know is that the investigators had all the texting records. Singleton asked, do you think it's possible maybe the accident occurred when he was reading your text? I don't think so, because he told me right after. He said that he had just... He's not one to sit there and text and stuff while he drives. He'll hardly, like, even pick up the phone or anything while he's driving. Singleton's frustration was simmering. He pulled out the phone logs. These are a list of text messages. They start... The crash happened at 6:49. The texting starts prior to that time. 6:43, 6:45, 6:46, 6:47. These are all happening when he was driving. Singleton had gotten the crash time slightly wrong. It was more like between 6:47 and 6:48. But he made his point. Brianna. Singleton elaborated, explaining that the texting started when Reggie left his house and that the investigation shows he was in the process of texting you and he crossed the center line and he clipped a... and the car spun out of control, spun sideways, and was hit by a pickup truck and it killed these two individuals. Singleton pulled out pictures of Keith and Jim that ran with their obituaries in the local paper. This is a father who has a daughter. And this one is a father who has two little children. They were both married. I would really like as much help as I could, because Reggie refuses to talk to us. I thought that he just texted me right after it happened. Singleton said he had records for 11 texts between Reggie and Brianna prior to the crash and for 13 texts afterward. And her dad then asked a question. So, these are responses. She sends a response and he sends one back. That's considered a text message? Yep, Singleton explained. He was trying not to show his frustration. This young woman remembered sending a text to say good morning, something so insignificant, and claimed not to remember anything else. The only one I remember is just like the one after the crash happened. Like he just texted me. That's all I remember about it. They went back and forth, gently parrying, trying to draw her out. Her dad said, I think it's important you tell them everything you know. I know. Every little detail. Like That's seriously all I remember about it. It was, you know, last September or so. This was just shy of halfway through the interview. The investigators quickly covered a bunch of other ground. Who else Brianna had talked to about the accident? How many texts she had sent that day? A bit about the process going forward. Brianna asked, "So, are you guys trying to get it so he goes to jail?" "What we want is accountability," Agent Olson responded. "If someone were to be texting and clipped your father while he was driving and your father was killed," he asked, "would you want accountability?" She had nothing further to offer. An indication of a standoff moving to a new phase, into a more formal legal arena with the sides entrenching. Indeed, by now, Singleton and Renlisbacher, emboldened by discovery, were nowhere near close to giving up. In fact, Brianna's own texting and phone records had offered them yet another level of indignation. Her record showed that she had sent Reggie 6 texts during his drive. He'd sent 5, and she'd sent 6. 11 texts sent and read by Reggie Shaw on his fateful drive. But Reggie didn't know anything of this discovery. He felt in the clear. Besides, something very good was about to happen. Or so it seemed. Reggie was in the living room when the call came in. It was the local bishop, Eldon Peterson. He'd taken over for David Lasley, the bishop who Reggie had lied to about having improper relations with his girlfriend. Reggie took the call on the landline. "Great news, Reggie." Before the next words came out, Reggie's eyes had already filled with tears. "You're going on a mission," Peterson told him. The bishop gave a few key details, namely, that Reggie would be leaving in less than 2 weeks. "Get your bags packed, kid. You're heading to Provo to the MTC, the Missionary Training Center, then to Canada, where you were supposed to go on the first mission. I know how hard you've worked, Reggie." Reggie wept with relief and joy. On June 7th at 3 p.m., Agents Singleton and Olson took another crack at Brianna, this time unannounced. They showed up at Buku's, a freight warehouse where she worked. They recorded the interview sitting in a back room with cubicles in it. They were the only people in the room, but they shared a cubicle, the three of them, doing the interview. Singleton was sure that Brianna wasn't telling them everything, and suspected she'd been coached, maybe by Reggie. By coming to her place of work, they could avoid having her dad in the room and press a little harder. Singleton explained that the prosecutors were now looking at the case. "In poring through the records, text and cell phone records, I got quite a bit of evidence. I know you haven't been totally upfront with me on what was said." "I haven't?" Brianna asked. Singleton again explained about the cell phone records, the 11 text messages that took place before or just during the accident. And Brianna responded, "That's what me and my dad were talking about after we left, you know, because, like, I thought, I told my dad, like, I thought I'd only text him once, but apparently I was texting him before. I don't know." "So you're saying you could possibly have been wrong?" "I could have been wrong, yeah. I wasn't completely sure." Singleton was feeling a light buzz, the thrill of closing in on some truth, something that had been elusive. He followed up by asking about her exchanges with Reggie after the accident. What did Reggie said? She explained, as in the previous interview, that he'd gotten into an accident. "They just ran into each other." Singleton, "I want to know absolutely everything." "I don't know what else to tell you. That's, like, honestly all I remember." Singleton's frustration returned. "He's looking at possibly a year at the maximum," the agent said. "Uh-huh." "An obstruction of justice charge is a felony. An obstruction of justice is when you have information and you don't provide that information." "I'm telling you honestly, like, everything that I know." The investigators turned their attention to before the crash. "So before the accident, were you two texting back and forth to each other?" Olson asked. "I guess, if it says we were. It shows 6:17 in the morning and there's 11 texts. So, I guess we were, yeah, Brianna answered. The investigators could see there would be no grand admission, beyond Brianna acknowledging the existence of the call records. She wasn't going to say that Reggie admitted to her what he'd been doing, or that he'd been doing it at the exact time of the wreck. At that point in the interview, Brianna's manager interrupted and asked how much longer the interview would take. The investigators began to wind down. They had a few more questions. Singleton asked Brianna about a phone call that took place just a week earlier, the night before their previous interview of her. He had gotten the phone records, and he could see that Brianna and Reggie had spoken. He wanted to know if Reggie had coached her. "Did he give you any indication of how to answer questions, or don't tell them this or that?" "No, he never said that. He just said, like, answer honestly is all he said. I don't think he's trying to hide anything." Singleton left disappointed. He knew the prosecutors were on the fence at best about charging Reggie with negligent homicide. It would have helped if Brianna could have said something to the effect that Reggie had confessed culpability, or said something about texting, or even coached her to obstruct the investigation. "I was hoping there would be some kind of smoking gun, but it didn't exist." On June 11th, Mary Jane called Bunderson and told him that Reggie was planning to leave in 10 days for the Mission Training Center, then on to Winnipeg. Bunderson put in a message to Michael Glauser, the attorney for the church, seeking guidance. Reggie was on his way. Chapter 23. The Lawmakers. In May of 2007, as Singleton hunted for answers, the governor of the state of Washington, Christine Gregoire, signed into effect the first state law banning texting while driving. She was, according to the Seattle Times, flanked by children who suffered serious injuries after being hit by drivers. The article noted that the texting ban, which would go into effect the following January, would carry a $101 fine for violators, while a second measure, also signed by the governor, would ban motorists from using a handheld phone. That law would go into effect in July 2008. Across the country, legislators were grappling with whether to regulate cell phone use by drivers. The most intriguing battle had gone on in California. There, a state legislator named Joe Simidian, whose district included Palo Alto, the heart of Silicon Valley, had been nearly beside himself since 2001 as he battled the cell phone industry over a proposed ban on handheld phone use by drivers. When he'd first introduced legislation, he stood in front of a legislative committee and explained that all he was asking for was to codify into law something that, he said, the cell phone companies already acknowledged. Using a handheld cell phone while driving was dangerous. For instance, in an early hearing at the State House in April 2001, Simidian, a Democratic assemblyman, later elected to the state Senate, read from Sprint's own marketing materials. "When using your Sprint PCS phone in the car, focus on driving, not talking, and use your hands-free kit," the document read. "Failure to follow these instructions may lead to serious personal injury and possibly property damage." As Simidian stood at the podium, reading the document, trying to reconcile the company's clear recognition of the risks with its opposition to law, he said, "I am at an absolute loss." But year after year, his legislation had been killed. Lobbyists from the major cell phone companies, including Singular, Sprint, and AT&T, threw a kitchen sink of arguments against the rule, arguing, among other things, that mobile phones pose no different a distraction than other tasks, like eating. Lobbyists for Sprint argued that a law banning handheld phone use could be used to discriminate against minority motorists, who were more likely to be pulled over because of racial bias by police. Broadly, the carriers argued that general education was sufficient to remind motorists about the risks of getting distracted by their devices, never mind that cell phone use by drivers was exploding. In fact, Simidian pointed out that the California Highway Patrol had been collecting data since 2001 and found that cell phone use was the number one cause each year in distractions leading to car accidents. In 2006, after 5 years of battling, he got his bill passed. It was signed by the governor in September of that year and was slated to take effect in July 2008 to give law enforcement, consumers, and companies time to adapt. Next up for Semidian was a texting ban. But the idea of Utah getting in on the action seemed unlikely and even preposterous. This was, after all, a deeply red state, one that by numerous measures was among the top five most conservative states in the country. State legislators did not look kindly on government regulations they felt would impinge on personal freedoms. By way of example, there was no primary law requiring the use of seatbelts by drivers, and no law requiring motorcyclists to wear helmets. About the time legislators in other states were thinking about restricting bans on cell phones for motorists, Utah legislators were busy rejecting a different safety measure, to require booster seats for children up to the age of 8 years old, recalled Carl Wimmer, a Utah policeman turned state lawmaker from a Salt Lake City suburb and one of the more conservative members of the state legislature. And he sat on the Law Enforcement and Criminal Justice Committee, which was a gateway for these sorts of legislation. Wimmer recalled safety advocates and families coming to the hearings. They'd line up these kids who would come up and say, "Please help save my life," he said. Wimmer felt for them, to the point that he at one point put up $1,000 of his own money to buy booster seats and give them away to any family who wanted one. But he wouldn't vote for such a law, arguing that it was just another example of the government sticking its nose into people's business. He felt the same about texting and driving bans. If you're going to live in a free society, you have to give people the liberty to do what they want. Chapter 24. The Neuroscientists. In April 2012, Dr. Atchley attended a traffic safety conference in Orlando, Florida. He found himself on a panel with an internet addiction expert with a particularly intimate knowledge of addiction, having spent time himself in rehab. His name? David Greenfield. In the early 1970s at Paramus High School in northern New Jersey, when Greenfield was just shy of 15 years old, he was called to the principal's office and given a choice: go to rehab or get expelled. It was post-Vietnam, a hippie era, a culture of encouragement and defiance around drugs. And adding to that, Greenfield's family was under duress. His dad, a graphic designer, and his mom, an art teacher and art therapist, were on the rocks. A very unstable marriage, with four kids, David being the oldest and most sensitive. By 14, David was experimenting with drugs, marijuana, barbiturates, LSD. Then he started taking and selling painkillers from his parents' medicine cabinet. "It was a cry for help," he says, looking back. "My parents' marriage was crumbling." He spent 4.5 months at a place called Harold House, an inpatient rehab center in an old warehouse. He got clean. Still, he said, his high school guidance counselors had thrown in the towel on him. They were wrong. David became a psychologist, earning a PhD in 1986 from Texas Tech University, and eventually becoming an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine. He now brings a particularly personal perspective to the debate about addiction. He's the director of the Center for Internet and Technology Addiction, one of the first places in the world to treat technology addiction as a medical disorder. "What's happening today with technology," he argues, "is comparable to what happened in the 70s with drugs. It's exactly the same. The pace of adoption of technology and cultural acceptance isn't that much different than the pace of adoption and cultural acceptance of the drug culture, except that one is legal and one isn't." He gets raised eyebrows. At conferences, people say, "Give me a break. Technology's not like cocaine or heroin or crack, where you can see the tissue damage in the brain." They say, "There's no proof of increasing tolerance levels to technology, and people can walk away from their devices." Dr. Atchley, while an admirer of Dr. Greenfield, isn't convinced that technology is addictive per se, though Dr. Atchley remains open to the debate. The so-called Bible on the question of psychological illnesses is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM. The disorders and their classifications change with each edition, reflecting new science and understanding. Its committees have grappled with the question of technology addiction, but haven't made it an official diagnosis. For now, it falls into a broader category: impulse control disorders not otherwise classified. According to a 2012 article titled, "Are Internet and Video Game Playing Addictive Behaviors?" scholars from Yale and University College London concluded that the features of an impulse control disorder are a failure to resist an impulse, drive, or temptation to perform an act that is harmful to the person or others. It goes on. The individual feels an increasing sense of tension or arousal before committing the act, and then experiences pleasure, gratification, or relief at the time of committing the act. To an extent, this is a semantic conversation. The Yale paper notes that the word addiction derives from the Latin addicere, which translates to enslaved to or bound by. They are broad definitions. It was only in the last 30 or so years that the definition came to be narrowed to substance abuse, notes Mark Potenza, a psychologist at the Yale School of Medicine and an expert in addiction science who was one of the paper's co-authors. In short, most researchers don't put texting or video game playing or internet use in the same category as addictive drugs. They might be compelling, say many researchers, but not addictive. To Dr. Greenfield, it's mere semantics. Whether the word is impulse or compulsion or addiction, clearly there is an overtaking of rational, logical processing of information and judgment like we see with other drugs, he says. He's worth hearing out. For one, the way he describes and breaks down our day-to-day interaction with our devices is extremely resonant. His analysis rings true. Also, even though technology is not classified as addictive, some neuroscience points to stark similarities between how technology use and drug use trigger chemical release in the brain. In 1998, right about the time that Dr. Greenfield sensed the lure of computer technology, neuroscientists at the Imperial College School of Medicine in London observed the brains of 8 male subjects playing a video game. The game entailed using a computer mouse to direct a virtual tank through a battlefield. Subjects had to collect flags while avoiding and destroying enemy tanks.